Elbphilharmonie Talk, der Gesprächspodcast der Elbphilharmonie.
Hello, dear friends. Very warm welcome to the Elbphilharmonie Talk. This is Tom Schulz speaking. I had a very beautiful conversation just a couple of days ago with the American composer John Luther Adams, whose piece Inuk Seward will be performed by mid-May in the public park in downtown Hamburg called Planten und Blumen. And we spoke about that piece, we spoke about his music, and we spoke about the state of the earth and nature and what art has to do with it and how art can probably change the world. And I spoke with him via Zoom. John Luther Adams has lived for many decades in Alaska, and at one point he got apparently sick of it and moved all the way down south to New Mexico, close to the Mexican border. And this is where I caught him. And he sat in a very beautiful wooden cabin, and there were lots of windows, and there was much light coming in. And he was very serene and wonderful. And I hope you enjoy what we came up with. So this is how we spoke. Very happy to see you and to talk to you, John.
Lovely to see you.
Thank you. As you are, of course, very well aware of, is that we are going to perform Inuk Seward on the 15th of May this year within the framework of a festival called Internationales Musikfest Hamburg. And first of all, I just want to make sure that I do pronounce this piece right, because I heard you say it once and you said Inuk Seward, and others say it would be Inuk Shoot. So what's the truth here?
The truth is, none of us speak Inuit, so we probably can't pronounce it. But I've actually always said Inuk Seward, which is as close to what I hear my friends and neighbors up north say.
Cool.
Because Inuk Seward.
Inuk Seward, exactly, like mm-hmm. four syllables, Inuk Seward. Mm-hmm. Because some people say, you know, Inuk Shud would be like the singular form, and Inuk Seward would be more of those stone artifacts.
That is correct. That is correct. Inuksuk is singular. Inuk Seward is plural.
Okay. Can you tell me a bit about the genesis of this piece for you? How did it come about? What is the idea behind it?
Well, you know, Tom, Inuk Seward are the stone sentinels that Inuit people have built across the circumpolar Arctic for countless centuries. And I have spent most of my life in Alaska.
About 40 years or so?
Yes, 40 years in Alaska. So Alaska is my home in the deepest sense, although I now live elsewhere. I will always identify as an Alaskan, as a northerner. And I've had the experience of seeing here and there Inuk Seward on the Arctic coastal plain. And you're out there immersed in all this space and light and distance that just seems to go on and on and on forever, and you come across a pile of stones that clearly have been made by humans. Mm-hmm. Who knows when? Who knows why? But that pile of stones is evidence of the presence of humans in this vast, windswept landscape. The Inuit word Inuk Seward or Inuk Seward translates somewhat roughly as to act as in the capacity of the human. Mm-hmm. Some people think that all Inuk Seward represent human figures. They do not. That's a very special class of Inuksuit.
Which can be identified by those who know more about it.
Yes, and you know, sometimes those figures, Inungwait, I believe they're called, you see arms, legs, head. You see that this is supposed to resemble a human being.
Humanoids.
Exactly. The stone people who live in the wind.
Mm-hmm.
But most Inuksuit actually are markers of the best route between here and there, or a place where the fishing is good, or where caribou can be hunted easily, or perhaps an Inuksuk marks some event where people were weathered in for a while, couldn't travel, and so they just built something. Mm-hmm. Or other Inuksuit are so old and so steeped in mystery that we have no idea what they might mean. And I love that.
And they clearly inspired you to write this open piece for 9 to 99 percussionists.
Yes. And you know, I've lived most of my life, Tom, in out-of-the-way places. I guess, like Thoreau, I'm some kind of misanthrope.
And a hermit.
I am hermetic, and you know, I feel most fully present in solitude, and for better or for worse, in order for me to do my work, I need solitude. So I composed Inuksuit in, I don't know, 2007, 2008. You may know better than I.
Mm-hmm.
In my solitary studio in the woods in Alaska, my one room cabin with a wood burning stove.
Beautiful.
And as I worked, I had this image of those solitary figures standing out on the Arctic coastal plain. And I imagined each musician and each individual listener as a solitary figure. So I thought I was composing a piece about solitude. Trick on me. It wasn't until I heard the first performance of Inuksuit, the premiere at the Banff Center in Alberta, Canada,
mm-hmm.
that I realized, no, Inuksuit is a piece about community. I imagined each musician as a soloist, and in fact, it's true.
Mm-hmm.
Each individual musician in a performance of Inuksuit is playing something absolutely unique.
Mm-hmm.
Each musician is a soloist. So is each listener. Because there is no best seat in the house. There is no preferred listening point from which to experience this piece. This is outdoor music, and you may choose to root yourself in one location as a listener and let the music revolve around you. Or, as many people do, you may follow your ears wherever they may lead you, and actively create your own mix, so to speak, of the piece. So each individual listener's experience of Inuksuit is unique, just as each individual musician's performance is unique.
Would you then recommend to rather not listen to the recording that's available on Spotify? Like, this is such an interesting piece, you know, you have, once you listen to it, you think, oh, okay, this is how he meant it. And then it has its own narrative, so to speak.
Perhaps it does, but I think that narrative is in your mind, as the mind
sure.
of the listener.
Absolutely.
And you know, as is true with all music. But even more than most music, and even more than much of my own music, there is no definitive performance of Inuksuit. And that is the beauty of it, right? It's all about discovering the music in the place where it is performed. This is not a wilderness piece, mm-hmm. even though it was inspired by my own experiences of wild country in the Arctic, and by this image of those solitary figures in the Arctic. This piece, this music, Inuksuit, is all about place, wherever we may be. And I'm delighted. I couldn't have imagined, Tom, when I composed this in the early days of this century, it was preposterous. Mm-hmm. You know, I'm composing a piece for up to 99 percussionists to be performed only out of doors. What a ridiculous proposition.
And a bold proposition, too.
Well, you know, it's just what I do as my life's work. I follow the music wherever it seems to want to lead me. I do my best to follow it. Mm-hmm. But again, a delightful trick on the composer. Inuksuit, which seemed so impractical, so outlandish, has become one of my very most frequently performed works.
You just had a Swiss premiere last weekend?
It's taken on a life of its own, entirely independent of the composer, which, mm-hmm. of course, is what the composer always wants. Somebody joked that it's my In C.
You know, yes, I know.
Like Terry Riley. Terry Riley's piece.
Yeah, yeah.
So the piece that everybody everywhere plays all the time, in part, well, just because it's wonderful and uplifting to hear, but also because of this community spirit in the music. It's mm-hmm. a do-it-yourself kind of thing. Mm-hmm. It's what we say now, create your own adventure, right?
Yeah.
So out of that experience, with each performer being a soloist and each individual listener having her or his own experience, out of this collection of shared solitudes, this extraordinary sense of community arises. So it turns out that, again, that this piece that I thought was about solitude is all about community. It's an invitation to remember where we are and how we fit in.
So it's a very dialectical kind of result that you have created unwillingly.
One might even say unwittingly.
Yeah.
Witlessly. Yeah. You know, and not to put too fine a point on it, Tom, but, you know, it's back to that idea of Inuksuit acting in the capacity of the human. We're living in a time of great violence and inhumanity. Mm-hmm. We're doing violence. We're acting inhumanly toward one another and toward the earth, which is the only home any of us will ever know. A piece like this, again, turns out to be... this was not in my mind, but I realized this is a model. Inuksuit is a little model of the society in which I would like to live, a society in which each one of us feels that rootedness in our place, wherever we are, wherever our place may be, and our sense of obligation to one another, to our fellow human beings, our members of our human community, but also to all other forms of life.
So an interconnectedness with all that, all sentient beings, so to phrase it Buddhistically.
Yes, and you know, it's a lot to hang on a piece of music.
Sure.
But it turns out that somehow this piece embodies those aspirations.
Yeah,
for me.
It's so interesting because I spoke about the narrative earlier that immediately just came to my mind listening to this recording, you know, with the mm-hmm. bird song in the beginning and then the bird song in the end, and in the middle uh-huh. it's just been taken you know, it's overpowered by the drumming for yes. the better part of the piece. But then
it's apocalyptic in the middle, isn't it?
It is. It's quite apocalyptic. And then you come back with the chimes. Then the frequencies get higher, and at the end the birds are there again. And then you add those flutes, like identical. And I wonder. I mean, outdoors in Hamburg downtown, you know. Of course, here and there, there might be a bird passing by, but this predominance of the bird song, which is so clearly hearable and audible on the recording, will not be there.
And you know, that's fine. Whenever possible, I try to use transcriptions of the songs of birds that may be present in the specific site of a performance. Mm-hmm. I've been trying to dig out some Western European bird songs that I transcribed several years ago. I haven't found them yet. But, you know, again, it gets back to what I was saying about the piece not being a nature piece per se, or not being what we usually think of as nature, but nature including human nature. And so... I am delighted when Inuksut is performed in urban locations. And the mm-hmm. ending of the piece, yes, has something to do with the beginning and the ending of the piece have something to do with birds. But what it's really about is the music of the place. Whatever that music may be in whatever place. So I've had experiences. I remember a performance in a city park, in Morningside Park in New York City. And after the storm of the middle of the piece, all the thundering drums and crashing cymbals and roaring mm-hmm. tam-tams, as things gradually settle down, and the higher sounds come in, as you described, suddenly we began to hear the traffic out on the perimeter of the park, the tires of cars, or a siren in the distance, or children playing and laughing farther down in the park. And what happens in a performance of Inuksut is that we remember how to listen to where we are. And for mm-hmm. me, mm-hmm. That's where the piece leaves you. Yes, with the poetry of bird songs, but more with refreshed ears, with newly opened ears to the music all around us all the time.
Yeah. You know that we are also trying to incorporate to some extent recycled material into the instrumentarium, so to speak, of the piece.
I love this.
And are you fine with that?
I love it.
Cool.
You know, as I've said in conversations about this, I love the idea and I must love the sound also. You know, if we use recycled materials and they sound as good as conventional instruments, then great. The music has to come first. The instruments have to resonate with the same presence and impact and beauty of the sound of conventional instruments.
Mm-hmm.
But I've heard. In a subway station in New York, you know, you sometimes come across this guy on the platform who's got this drum set made out of plastic buckets and cans, and it's great.
And the sound is fantastic.
It's fantastic. Yeah, yeah. So I'm certain that we're going to be using the recycled instruments made out of recycled materials, and it's going to sound great. I love it.
Fantastic. Great. John, let's speak briefly at least about your famous trilogy, the Become series.
Sure.
First question is probably a little silly, but it's a serious question though. Is this trilogy complete with the river and the sea and the desert, or is there possibly something coming up, like now you're living in 6,000 feet altitude, become mountain, become city probably?
It's not a silly question. It's an obvious question. And it's one that I've asked myself again and again. But I have a very direct answer from you, given by my wife, my partner and best friend, 43 years now. And she said, John, no more becoming. She thought, okay, we don't want this to become some sort of marketing gimmick, some sort of shtick. But of course, everything that I do, my whole life's work is my own search to become the place in which I am living, or to become mm-hmm. part of the never-ending music of what we call nature. To become, right now, we're about to premiere an enormous new, another preposterous orchestral piece called An Atlas of Deep Time. You know, it could be called Become Earth, Become Rock. So the aspiration is the same, but I just have been told I can't use become in the titles anymore.
And there is some magic in the three, of course. I mean, you know, it's a perfect number. So
yeah,
maybe it also makes sense to not add a fourth and a fifth.
Yeah, those pieces become ocean, become desert, become river, all evolved within a particular period of time. They all were within, I don't know, I'd have to look at the dates, but 4 or 5 years of one another. So they felt somehow like a family of compositions. Mm-hmm. And now in equally large and audacious pieces, I'm exploring fire. I'm exploring stone. The Become trilogy, you know, I guess is water and space and light with Become mm-hmm. Desert. Become Desert is all about light.
I'm so happy that you say that, because that's what I basically hear in that piece. It's just a very mind-blowing, you know, oral translation of the visual and of what we perceive with the body and with the skin, and this light quality is just amazing.
Thank
it's an immersive
you.
Experience.
Thank you. You know, the piece is not as well known as Become Ocean. But in some ways, I think it's I may love it more, and that mm-hmm. that
me too.
That aspiration to give voice to light comes from a line in a poem by the great Mexican poet Octavio Paz, and he says, "Close your eyes and listen to the singing of the light." And I've had that experience out in the desert, you know, just sitting and feeling the warmth, but more hearing the light.
Yeah, that's fabulous. And that's what I, for lack of a better word, call immersive, because it really takes the entirety of the human into this experience. You know, it's not just a listening anymore. It's more than that.
Well, of course, you know, it's all part of part of the same electromagnetic spectrum. These are just different frequencies from that are within or just beyond the realm of our ears or our eyes. And I like to imagine somehow that in my music I'm working with those very elemental qualities of earth, air, fire, water, light, time.
time is another key element, of course. I mean, in every music, but again, also in your music, you kind of, you know, you dissolve time, or the known time concept just kind of, you know, seems to become less important, I would say.
Of course, at a certain point, you know, we could quote the Book of Revelation or Parsifal or Samuel Beckett. You know, they all have references to the same thing. At a certain point, space and time become are the same thing. I mean, that's quantum physics, isn't it?
Zum Raum wird hier die Zeit.
Exactly.
yeah.
So in my recent music, and maybe in a way this began, well, it maybe began way back with my earliest pieces with bird songs, but Inuksuit was a very important moment in which I began to think of space, of physical volumetric space, of the space that we inhabit with our bodies, mm-hmm. as a fundamental compositional element. This is, of course, nothing new. I mean, Gabrielli was doing it in San Marco and, you know, in the Renaissance, right?
With the choirs and stuff.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. But mm-hmm. in recent years, space has become a fundamental compositional element for me, not only in my outdoor works, but even in my indoor music. So that, mm-hmm. you know, when I'm doing what I call foundation work, beginning to try and imagine, try and understand what the music wants to become next, one of the first questions I ask myself is, well, what are the sounds? But now, in addition to that, the question becomes, and where are the sounds located in space?
Okay.
So that
it's not only foreground, background, it's a more multidimensional surround experience.
Yes, exactly. Which is, you know, how we are in the world, or how when we're not on these
absolutely
silly yeah. screens, compressing time and space beyond beyond any real dimension, this is how we experience the world. When we take a walk in a forest, we're immersed in sound and light, mm-hmm. and the earth beneath our feet and space. And so I want that now in my music from the ground up, from the beginning. I want it in my music, not only in the outdoor works such as Inuksuit or Sila or Crossing Open Ground or Across the Distance. I've done a number of outdoor works since Sila, mm-hmm. but I also want it in my indoor works, in my orchestral works for sure. You know, Become Ocean has the orchestra deployed as three different ensembles. Become Desert, mm-hmm. the orchestra is five different ensembles. And in this new piece we're about to premiere, An Atlas of Deep Time, it's six ensembles. I want to be inside of the music.
Okay.
That's where I want, what I want for myself as a listener is what I want for you. I want you to be immersed in a strange, beautiful, maybe frightening place and to get lost in it.
And so we go back from Gabrielli way to Stockhausen Gruppen and to these, you know, surround experiences.
I was absolutely
sometimes even
yes.
simultaneously played stuff.
Yes, yeah. I was absolutely. When I said Gabrielli, and then I thought Gruppen. Absolutely.
Yeah. See.
Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. Yeah. It's interesting also because I think, you know, like Become Ocean, and then of course immediately Debussy comes to mind, La Mer, and this. Is there some feeling of continuity in your own thinking of music that you have that in mind, and that, you know, or Ligeti atmospheres, you know, this quality of time space leveling music?
I love Ligeti. I love Ligeti. I love Debussy. I'm almost 70 now, and as the sculptor Richard Serra says, at a certain point, an artist has assimilated all the influences and is just working from out of the work itself. And I think I'm at that point. It's always been my inclination, Tom. I am a bit of a recluse or a hermit or a misanthrope, and I need, for better or for worse, I need to feel like primitive man discovering fire. You know, so if I'm thinking about Debussy or Ligeti or, you know, God forbid, Wagner or, you know, Gabrielli or Stockhausen or anyone else.
Any of the above, yeah.
It doesn't work. I have to feel as though I'm in virgin territory and I'm just trying to find my way. But yes, absolutely. Also, I'm so intimidated by, well, Debussy in particular. I mean,
yeah.
There's no way I could even think about Debussy while I'm composing.
It would stop you composing, probably.
Yes. Yes.
I totally understand. John, it's wonderful conversing with you. I really enjoy this very much. One maybe final question already, because we have like this formative about half an hour for our conversations in this podcast series. Of course, you were not in Switzerland at the premiere of Inuk Suite last weekend, and you are in your cabin in New Mexico. And I wonder, is this also like a conscious decision to not travel to all these now maybe very intriguing premieres of your work all over the world out of responsibility towards the environment? Or is it just the hermit that says, oh, I'm so happy to stay home?
It's a perfect storm. It's a perfect convergence of both. You're right. There are all these wonderful things happening with the music now. Performances happening in places that I would love to go. Musicians that I would love to hear bringing new perspectives to the music. I would love to be there in Hamburg to not only hear the performance but also feel the presence of the listeners, to feel the community,
and the city. Yeah,
absolutely. I would love that. At this stage in my life, I could be on airplanes all the time, going here and there. But just before the pandemic, I realized that I was the world's largest hypocrite. Here I was espousing, a certain sense of reverence and responsibility toward the earth. And I've been speaking about and writing about climate change, you know, since the last days of the 20th century. And yet here I was jetting around here and there, and especially living in Alaska. You know, Mike, I had the carbon footprint of a small African nation. And that's just not acceptable. So the pandemic forced me to walk my talk, or maybe not walk my talk, right? To stay home.
That was exactly the term I was about to speak out, walk your talk, and just, yeah, don't do it.
And, you know, I'm a slow worker anyway, Tom. So, given my hermetic ways, given my concern with what we are doing to the atmosphere of the earth, and we all know that jet travel is an enormous contributor, and given the fact that I'm a slow worker and I just need to be in my studio, all of these things have come together and allowed me to just settle into, as I approach 70 now, settle into a new way of living and working. I just, one day is, one day is the same as the next. As Madame Stravinsky said once in an interview, and my wife would howl at this, someone was talking with her and she said, in this house, there are no holidays.
Oh, yeah. Oh, yeah.
I work all the time.
Well, that's the creative mind, you know.
It's what I live to do. So I just feel blessed to have lived long enough and to still have both of my marbles, as we and at least to feel that there is the possibility that my best work lies ahead of me. But if so, the only the only way I'm going to do that work is by being in my studio, not by hopping on planes and going to performances everywhere. Long answer to your question, but it's a really good question. And it's a question.
Thank you.
It's a question that each one of us is, all of us are asking ourselves in various ways in our own lives. You know, what is my obligation to my community, to the larger community of life on this earth? What is the best thing that I can do? And my answer to that question is the best thing I can do is stay in my studio and make music that I hope may be of use to the next generations. That's really what keeps me going, Tom, is my love for the young people who are coming up now and are going to take over hopefully soon and begin to try and imagine a new way of being in the world and try to build a new human societies, new human cultures out of the rubble that my generation is leaving for them.
Left behind, yeah.
It's the young people who keep me going. I love them and I wish them all the best. And my highest aspiration now is to leave something that may be useful to them.
Thank you, John. Thank you. And I think there will be very, very many young people also, you know, listening to your Inuk Suite in Hamburg. And I was just thinking, you know, of this kind of maybe esoteric idea of maybe us humans, we have to change our appearance and really shine with our absence sometimes. So shine with your absence when this piece will be performed in Hamburg. So in a way, energetically, you will be very present.
Thank you. Thank you for saying that.
Thank you, Jean.
What a pleasure.
Still looking forward to somehow meet you somewhere.
I would love that. You know, every time, yes, I'm a hermit. And yes, I love my splendid isolation, but I also need community. My work is not finished until it enters into community and other people, listeners, performing musicians, thoughtful people who write and talk about music and art, make it their own.
And well, you embody the dialectics we spoke about earlier, you know, Inuk Suite being a piece about solitude and ending up a piece about community. And you being such a solitary artist, searching and needing and, of course, fulfilling himself somehow also in community, or at least in the response of the community.
Every time I'll get off of our conversation, this maybe not for the podcast, but every time I speak with somebody in Germany, I think, you know, maybe we should see if they take us in Germany. I mean, there's just such a...
immediately.
There's such a beautiful, deep history and sense of the centrality of art and culture in human experience. I mean, this is what, if we look at history, it is art that embodies art, and I would say the best of science, and a thin sliver of the very best of religious thought, that embodies
very thin sliver.
Yes, but embodies the highest aspirations of humanity, and the moments and the ways in which we have come closest to realizing those aspirations, and
yeah.
Yeah, well, we may wind up in Germany yet.
So, John, Hamburg is a cool place. It's a very cool place, not only temperature-wise, but it's a very nice place. And we would have place for you, be assured of that.
That's so wonderful. You know, I'm so ignorant of of geography and culture. I mean, I know what I know, and I know that very deeply. But I, in preparation for our conversation, I looked up the orchestra, but in the hall, oh my goodness, that beautiful
hall isn't so shabby, isn't it?
Woo, and the location, and then I started reading about the history of Hamburg. And, you know, of course I knew about Brahms, I knew about the Beatles in Hamburg, I knew about these things, but just looking at photographs of that city, oh my goodness, what a powerful spot geographically, and how beautiful architecturally that city is.
Have you ever been to Germany before at all?
I have never been to Germany. The closest I've been is Switzerland. France, Netherlands, okay. Belgium. I've never been to Germany.
So maybe, you know, like Greta Thunberg, you take a sailboat and come all over the Atlantic Ocean and you know, take a train, travel through Europe all the way to Hamburg.
The train's there. They want me to come to France next year for something, a big European premiere. And I looked at, well, right on the border, right, Strasbourg. And I looked at, well, you
at
know.
The Rhine.
Yes. And if we drove between Paris and I looked at that, and I can't remember what the drive was, but it's maybe 7 hours or something. Then I looked at the train, and it was an hour and a half. And I thought, this is civilization.
Yes, yes. It's a very rapid connection.
Unbelievable. So don't be too surprised if I show up.
Yeah. At some time. No, I won't. I won't. John.
Thank you so much.
Thank you so much. It was really a great, great pleasure talking to you.
Likewise.
Elbphilharmonie Talk, der Gesprächspodcast der Elbphilharmonie. Dieser Podcast wird vermarktet durch die Podcastbude.